The Operations Leadership Podcast with Gautam Basu provides insights for today's business leaders on creating value through operations improvement, process excellence, digital innovation, and organizational leadership.
Hello and welcome to the Operations Leadership Podcast. Today we have a special guest, Mr. William Bundy. Will is a partner at McKinsey's U.S. practice, and he's an acclaimed expert in operational value creation in the private equity industry. In this interview, he provides us with some very valuable insights on how PE firms have evolved from traditional financial engineering to more complementary approaches for value creation. He also discusses the importance of operations due diligence, as well as enabling analytical and Gen AI for ops improvement, the rise of operating partners in the private equity industry, and the future of value creation in PE. We hope you enjoy this interview.
All right. Welcome to the Operations Leadership Podcast, William.
Thank you very much, Basu, and it's great to be here.
Excellent. Well, I wanted to ask you a simple question to get us started. Could you tell us a bit about your background and specifically what got you interested in operations?
Absolutely. So, I mean, operations is critical to, and underpins all of what occurs in the economy and occurs in the world. And when I started out as coming out of college, I became a Navy submarine officer. I'd gone to the Naval Academy, and I actually operated nuclear reactors and submarines for 12 years of my life, right? I had a team of 75 people, had operational control of $1 billion-plus nuclear reactor, responsibility for maintenance, repair, and overhaul of a $2 billion submarine. And so that got me really excited about what operations can do for a company and for an entity. And I really also got to see what happens when operations are doing well and when they're not. My last role in the Navy, I was actually brought in to overhaul and basically kind of repair something that had occurred with the organization in the past. There, I also started to understand the power of transformative leadership and also the importance and criticality of ensuring that the team has adequate foresight into what needs to occur such that they can actually be empowered to actually deliver the operations that are necessary for the asset. We went through a two-year transformation, and at the end of it, the team did exceptionally well. I give myself very, very little credit, but the team that I worked with was absolutely phenomenal. The chiefs, the petty officers, all exceptionally talented. And being able to unlock that value was instrumental and really kind of drove my career thoughts afterwards. Following that, and I went to the Pentagon for a short period of time to kind of, I always have had this interplay between operations and strategy, right? Operations is just my nature and like how I think about things. I think about it at a tactical detail level, but then my conceptual problem solving is exceptional. And so I also end up in these positions where I'm like dealing with high level strategy and how you actually get that into the executional phase. And so I ended up in the Pentagon doing a bunch of work there. And then I shifted over to the private sector. And there I started to really excel. I went to Bain & Company. I learned about how operations and companies work. I did my first merger and an acquisition. And if you're ever thinking about how do you actually learn how a company truly functions, mergers and acquisitions and carve-outs are the absolute best way to kind of think about it. It really breaks down the hybrid organism that a company is between humans, systems, and then the processes. And makes you have to digest it and understand how you actually can put it together again on the other side of a transaction. From there, I went to Alex Partners, and I really honed my craft around, operational value creation and improvement. I actually even took on the equivalent of an interim COO role. And then when I left Alex Partners, I was brought in by a leading private equity firm to be what was supposed to be a chief transformation officer role. But I ended up owning, in addition to the large transformation, right? So it had actually been underwater or the asset was not necessarily making cash. So I actually had to lead it through a transformation, significant. And then in the midst of a global carve out, so I had to stand up operations across 32 geographies, banking accounts, a full logistics backend, and a 20-system ERP ecosystem deployment. And then they also said, you know what, Will, you're so good at this. Let's also give you legal, facility, and IT. And by the way, we're also going to give you interim chief supply chain officer. I said, okay, excellent. I'll take it all in. And I had And I owned a $200 million supply chain for a short period of time up until the permanent replacement was brought on board. That was definitely a fun time. And then after I finished up that role, I actually took some time off. I did a bunch of personal things, but then I ended up authoring a book called Creating Value in Portfolio Company Operations. And hopefully what I tried to do there and what I saw in the marketplace was private equity really understands financial engineering. They really understand kind of how it creates value in the market, but not everyone is really attuned to how you actually create value in the asset at a very pragmatic and practical level, right? And so what I tried to do was take the greatness that they have at that top of the house and strategic level and bridge the gap down to execution and what you really need to focus on when you're looking at an asset.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, it's a very impressive background. And could you explain to our listeners, those of the listeners that are not so familiar with private equity, how do private equity firms actually create value? Because you mentioned this traditional financial engineering approach, and there are some newer approaches to operational value creation. So could you talk a bit more around this topic?
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, so what private equity is and does, I'll start there as well, right? What private equity really is it's a conglomerate of investors that are backing a single, what they call a general partner, to go and make investments in companies, typically to take control of the asset. There's other mechanisms, there's hybrid, there's debt structures, in order to create value for the investors, right? And they're buying companies. When it first started, you know, like there's always the discussion, I think it was KKR with Barbarians at the Gate buying Kraft Nabisco, right? There's kind of quintessential stories. But the largest driver of the value was not necessarily what they did with the asset, but the acquisition and levering the balance sheet, right? That's kind of the traditional, what you call financial engineering. And the way to think about it, that is, it's as simple as a mortgage, right? Like if you buy a house, you put down 20%, you know, the other 80% you amortize over 30 years. And at the end of it, you walk away with your, you know, $200,000 home and you own it outright. The exact same way was thought through on the actual financial engineering side, right? You buy the company, you put down X percent, depending on what you can lever the balance sheet to, and then you just ride down the debt. And then that actually creates a pretty sizable return, somewhere between in the neighborhood of, you know, let's call it 10 to 15% returns. But what has occurred is that piece has started to, I'll say, be arbitraged away in the marketplace, right? People kind of know what an LBO is worth and what you're able to get out.
So now, and LBO is this leveraged buyout.
Yes, it's a leveraged buyout. Leveraged buyout being the levering of the balance sheet and amortizing it down. So what they've now shifted towards is, first they went towards revenue growth and like really backing good management teams. Then they went to a bit more of an operational tinge. We're now at a point where they have to actually go and underwrite the actual value creation in the asset. So what am I going to do differently? And when you really get to the discussion of what operational value creation is, it's going to down the path of creating structural change in a business that the market values, that also improves top line growth and improves the efficiency at the bottom line, right? So if you think about that statement, it kind of, you can break it down to like, including the financial learning, there's four buckets of real value creation, right? The first one is that financial improvement of the equity position of the company, or of the investors. That's the discussion of, hey, I'm going to lower the balance sheet and then I'm going to amortize it, or I'm going to put together some hybrid structure that creates value over time. One of the trends in recent past has actually been to invest in debt, like a warrant type debt instrument, where you actually can convert it over to equity over time. Another one, yeah, convertible note, exactly. The other one is multiple improvement through asset changes. And I'll talk about that one in a bit more detail, operational efficiency and then operating leverage growth. So those are the four main buckets. I'll talk about the last two first and then come back to this discussion of multiple improvement through asset changes. But operational efficiency and operating leverage gain. Operating efficiency is simple as I want to increase the cash flow of the company. How do I do that well? Well, I'm going to look at your overall operations. I'm going to identify the kind of key areas where you're not necessarily at benchmark or you're not necessarily operating as efficiently as you can. And then I'm going to look at how I can fix that part of the machine, right? A lot of companies have grown through serial acquisition. When they do that, sometimes they, not right, wrong, indifferent about the company, right? They don't take the time to fully integrate that asset into their operations. And so you end up with this system where there's four or five ERPs, enterprise resource planning. So think SAP, Oracle, NetSuite, Microsoft Dynamics, right? And then all of a sudden you have four or five of these systems. And then you take a look at it and you go, you know what, your finance and accounting team is five times as large as it's supposed to be. You know, what's going on with your company? Or what's going on in the operations? And they're like, oh, well, we have five ERPs. And then that obviously, it's not just FP&A usually, right? There's usually a bunch of back office staff. There's a bunch of admin. When you think about the reporting structure underneath that, it gets bloated as well, right? So then you kind of go, okay, well, listen, what we can do is we can invest and get those five systems consolidated down into one. And once you've done that, right now, that FP&A organization is essentially streamlined because you don't need people manning five systems anymore. You just need one. That's one lever of value creation, right? Just right there. And I've seen that happen a few times. Then the other part of this is you want to also create operating leverage gain. And the right way to think about that is it's like when you increase in revenue, you don't want your cost curve to go up in correlation with it, right? You actually want it to improve as it goes up. So there's multiple ways to do that, right? One is you actually try to seek productivity gains with the organization, right? How do I actually improve the processes? Like one of the things that we've done a lot of, and what you'll find is like sometimes people will do point solutions across a chain. Oftentimes what is sometimes better is just resetting the organization, right? Like you go down a path of saying, listen, I'm going to clean sheet your organization, like take a fresh sheet of paper and let's say, how can we do this better? Right. And there's a discussion that you get into like a fit for purpose model. And then there's some things that you do inside of that, that actually create a substantial amount of leverage. Like one of them is you actually look at weight labor arbitrage, both good and bad, by the way. Right. And so, and like, I'll just talk about this real quick, because what you also sometimes do is you actually look at the strategic footprint of the asset and you identify where you're going to allocate your headcount. And once again, it's not just always low cost, right? People always go, oh, you're going to offshore things. It's like true, because that part of the organization is not necessarily critical to the operations, or it doesn't, I'll say it this way, it doesn't create a competitive advantage for the company. Now, but then when you actually double click into that, right, you then say, well, what areas do create a competitive advantage for the company, right? And so let's say that you're a company that does a lot of marketing or marketing, right? Like, or you're supply chain heavy. You know what? Sometimes the right answer is not necessarily to shift supply chain to a small back office, right? If you're super supply chain intense, you actually want to find centers of gravity within your kind of, I'll say your area of operation that actually create, like have significant talent at like what you'd consider a relative value to the market. So for instance, Singapore has exceptional supply chain talent because it is one of the hubs of global commerce, right? If you think about what has occurred over the past 20 to 30 years. So there are some teams that actually will shift their supply chain team to Singapore. And it makes sense, right? Because they know how to handle global operations.
There's critical mass there.
Exactly. And the value of the person that you're getting for the economic input, right, is better than somebody that you're going to get in, you know, Montana, for instance, right? Not integrating Montana to say, but it's going to be someplace that you're going to find a little bit better value.
The final, and maybe a question on that, Will. Yeah. So when you talk about operating leverage, are you also talking about touching the operating model itself?
Yes.
Where you're actually looking at the organization and basically restructuring the organization, you know, around these centers of excellence, as you're mentioning.
Exactly. And so what you then do is, like, when you actually look at that operating model, you can fundamentally improve the way that the company is functioning. And like you'll, like when you actually go through that clean sheet process, what you also find is you actually have been doing a bunch of, I'll just call it unnecessary work in that system. And so just even taking out that unnecessary work, right, that streamlines how the organization functions, how people perform, right? It opens up time in the day for them to do things. And so all of a sudden, you know, your revenue can continue to grow at 10%, and you know, your cost curve is not growing at 10%. It might grow at 9, 8, 7. And that's phenomenal. The other thing you can also do there is, and this is that seeking of the operating leverage gain growth, is when you're looking at like, and there's a lot of times that private equity firms will buy a platform in an industry, and then they'll make strategic acquisitions called tuck-ins into that asset. And when you're doing that, right, good operators know that they need to actually go down a path of creating a system, and I'll say an IT environment that allows them to rapidly integrate all of those new acquisitions.
And this is the buy and build strategy, right?
Exactly. It's a buy and build strategy, but on the same side, there's also an operational way that you can structure the back end of the organization such that it can absorb whatever is coming at you in a very rapid way, right? Like, in, I think best in class is somewhere between 3 to 6 months for rapid tuck-ins, and you can just completely ingest the organization, right? And there's some shortcuts that you take there, but you can get that done very quickly. Now, the final bit that we also talked about was this multiple improvement through asset changes. And this one is kind of, I'll say, definitely something that's growing in popularity and something that requires the input of both the investor and the operators. Right. And the way to think about that one is, let's say that you're a North American company. Right now, the market values your consumer product company at, let's just call it 15x EV, 15 times EBITDA, right, to get an enterprise value, right, EV to EBITDA multiple. What you can sometimes find is nonlinearities in the market. So when you take a look at beauty, right, or beauty and like wellness, they might trade at 15x on dollar in the US. However, when you actually take a look at someone that's heavily weighted towards the Asian market, which people consider a higher growth market, that same type of asset with a Asian that is predominantly in Asia might trade at like an 18x. So now that creates a bunch of leverage that the investor can say, okay, listen, if I can buy this North American asset, I can do some diligence, see if it has the right cultural affinity for an Asian market. And then I can also start to build out that asset in an Asian market. And now what I've done is I've taken an asset that's being valued at 15x, and whatever dollar of revenue I'm getting over in Asia can potentially get valued at 18x. Now, the other thing that's also occurring, like here in the United States, and it also occurred in Europe, in recent past, but it's the transition from copper fiber in the telco space to copper to fiber in the telco space. And what happens there is once you've shifted your asset profile, it's somewhere between 50% to 60% of your revenue profile. We don't know, like, I don't know exactly where the tipping point is. The market kind of determines what that is, but all of a sudden you start to see that your multiple increases, right? And the exact multiples, you know, you can go somewhere from a 6x to a 9x, right? But once again, it allows the investor to look at that overall investment profile and go, listen, if I fundamentally change the underlying nature of this asset, I can actually create value for myself. And the best part about this is you also start to see that that is actually something that's sometimes doing good for the overall, right? For instance, fiber build out in the US, one of the biggest underpenetrated markets and underserved markets. As a matter of fact, the US is actually deploying what's called BEAD. I think it's broadened equity and access for digital infrastructure. But like, they're actually deploying funds in order to do that. Well, now you take that BEAD funding with private equity investment horsepower and analytical might, and all of a sudden you're actually broadening the actual impact that the US dollar has in infrastructure for the country. So, I mean, I think that it's a very powerful mechanism when you really start to think about some of these big changes. I know that there's a lot of investors now starting to look at infrastructure as well, right? Like, look, if you think about the energy transition that we all want to go through, right? This is another mechanism. If the market values green, you'll start to see more dollars pouring into that.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Yeah, thank you for that. Well, maybe a question on operational due diligence. Question, maybe some sub-questions here. How important is operational due diligence in the deal process? And why is it important to already identify, let's say, the operational value creation potential pre-deal? And maybe another follow-up subset question is, how is this used to improve outcomes?
Absolutely. So the way that investors, I think, are starting to evolve towards this, the answer to your question point blank, it is absolutely critical at this point in the, I'll say, the investment evolution of private equity and private capital, to really start to really have a fundamental value creation plan at the outset of every investment, right? We think value creation has to be at the forefront of private investing and across all four of those buckets that we just discussed. We actually are starting to think about this more as an expanded system, right? And there, it starts with prior to the acquisition, what does that look like, right? When you start to really get to a point that you're saying, listen, we're probably going to buy this asset, you probably want to have both your internal operating teams, and about 75% of private investors have those. There's 25% that actually don't. That was based on some other people's analysis and statistics. But and by the way, like, what you see is when you actually have internal operating partners, on average, you're seeing a higher increase in the actual return for the investors. I've seen anecdotes of, you know, about 0.5x money on money return. There's some other analysis that will say somewhere between 2-3% improvement in your IRR. So somewhere in that ballpark and range, sometimes it's hard to actually see it. There is some analysis that we've done in the background that actually shows the marked difference of when operating partners were not involved versus when they were. And you actually do see that the fundamental way that returns are made in private equity have expanded to include all four of those buckets versus prior to operating partners really kind of taking hold. It was really just focused on revenue and market gains, which is, it's an interesting concept and an interesting thing to kind of see. When we get back to this system that we were just discussing, you start with an adequate diligence, and that's really looking at a few things. One, you're looking at any red flags, right? Hey, you know, there's something wrong here, right? Like, and that starts with both on the financial side, right? So there's typically a financial due diligence. There's a commercial due diligence, right? And that looks at the strategic picture. And then there's this operational diligence, which is what we're going to focus on. That's really looking at those operational red flags, like, hey, there's something wrong here. Inventory destocking that's occurring. You know, they flooded the market. That's what's going on with their revenue, and that's why you've seen such exponential growth, right? You can understand all of that when you really get good operators in with a lot of experience that are really experts in a field, and you can really understand exactly what that's doing. As a matter of fact, here at McKinsey, what we're doing is we're actually building out an entire certification program for all of our analysts, such that they understand what value creation is in private equity and also know how to identify all the kind of key tips and tricks in order to actually create that and unlock that value, which is pretty powerful. We apply that across a 45,000 person organization. Now, on top of all of that, it also can, in depending on who you're working with, right? There's firms that have a good tacit understanding of things. There's others that don't, but you can actually put together what's called a value creation agenda or a plan, right? And it should typically touch on strategic, top line, and bottom line initiatives. And when we say a plan, it's literally at an initiative level, right? So you're going to say, listen, you need to convert your logistics operation in Ohio, as well as in France, over to a 3PL, because currently, you know, it's under managed because of X, Y, and Z. And here's all of the different metrics that indicate that that's the case. And on top of that, here's the quantum of dollars that we think they're going to accrete to the bottom line if you do that. And oh, by the way, here's the timing and here's how much it's going to cost. And when you get all of that in a line and you think about that on like 30 different initiatives on bottom line, there might be a handful, maybe 5 to 10 on top line. And then there might even be a strategic pivot. Listen, there's an adjacency that you guys are underpenetrated on that you could very quickly move into, right? One of the best examples is Yeti, right? Yeti was a hook and gun thing, right? Like you'd go out for a week long trip and like you put a Yeti in the back and then, you know, you put the fish in there, right? And then it would stay. And like everyone thought it was an amazing product because it was so well engineered, right? That then converted into adjacencies in, like, I remember when I first came across the name, I was doing some work in the oil and gas sector. And, you know, there was somebody, you know, it was a roughneck out on the rig, and he had a Yeti in the back. And he's like, yep, I can put my beer in there on Monday and it'll be cold on Friday. It's like, okay, excellent, right? But those are the sorts of things that you can kind of find. And then all of a sudden, what now look at Yeti, right? I think my dog's got a vest from Yeti at this point, right? Like, but like just because it's a quality product, that translates into market value. And so the more that you can kind of identify all of those key levers that you can do with an asset that you really get comfortable with, right? And that's one of the key things that does require experience is like, listen, I see where this person's going with this thought process. I've seen this before. We have a 10% chance of converting it over to X, Y, and Z. Okay, well, if that's the case, maybe I'm not going to underwrite that and I'm going to think about that on an upside case. But the things that I know are going to be able to hit and I know that I'm going to be able to deliver on, I'm going to give that a 75% probability. And so then you kind of go through all those, you rack and stack all of those things and you come up with what you really think you can underwrite on that asset, right? And then now all of a sudden I'm taking a company that was making $500 million. And now I'm saying, listen, by the time that I'm done with this, right, I put together what's called an EBITDA bridge. I'm going to be able to go from a $500 million company, $500 million EBITDA company to a $1 billion EBITDA company. And then I put in place what we call a fit for purpose management team. So this gets into the who's going to deliver it, right? And then I say, listen, here's who's going to deliver this value. And, you know, obviously the critical players are CEO, CFO, and then also the COO, depending on how operationally intensive the company is. For marketing-based companies, right, the chief marketing officer sometimes is. And sometimes that's not good enough, and I'll also put in what's called a chief transformation officer. That's the role that I played, right? So those people are then the team that I believe is going to be able to deliver this result for me. Now, the other piece that you also want to think about when you're trying to create those returns, though, is, okay, I have a team on the ground. Sometimes the team doesn't do well, right? So I need to have this interstitial that creates a system that monitors what these people are doing. And also make sure that when I say that I'm going to deliver $500 million in 5 years, that they're on track to do that. Right now, there's a board governance structure, all the way down to like transparency at a KPI level that you can put into place. Nobody's really cracked the nut on how to do that best, right? Because there are two different organizations, right? There's the fund and then there's also the company. But the more in what you see happen and who does exceptionally well is when the company leverages the fund on its behalf and like almost acts as an integrated team to deliver that end result. Because everyone is incented, by the way, to get to that $500 million difference. The key thing is if you start to act adversarial, that doesn't help, right? Whereas if you think everyone's on the same page and, oh, by the way, like making sure that everyone's delivering and understanding why they're not, if that's the case, then all of a sudden you start to see really good things happen in those assets.
So basically the incentives have to be aligned between the fund level and the actual portfolio companies
and people that are delivering. 100%, right? One of the things that private equity does fairly well is it incents the management team and it also incents all the key players. I think there's been some articles recently around KKR, but one of the funds actually giving equity to even below just the management team. And I think that's a great path forward. So that way you're actually giving some of that value to folks that are at the front lines and really delivering the work.
And you know, going back to the diligence, this value creation plan, so it goes way beyond, for example, the first 90 to 100 days. You're talking now 4 or 5 years, you know, into the
correct
the deal.
So the way to think about it is the first 180 days is critical, right? To kind of set the tone, figure out what needs to happen. And then after that, like, you get to a point that you've put in place the majority of the work on that value creation plan. Some of the more mature operational focused private equity firms, what they will also do is put in place a health check, right? So about the 2 to 3 year point, all of a sudden you just say, listen, we'd like to get an external set of eyes on the asset, kind of, or how you guys are doing, see if there's anything that you guys have missed, whatever. And they'll actually kind of bring in an advisor or their internal team to kind of go and take a look at the asset, just do a quick benchmarking, see if there's any gaps to kind of performance. That actually helps tremendously, right? Because you think that the asset's doing well, but you know what? There might be some unlocks. There might be a new technology that you didn't think about 3 years ago when you were underwriting this deal that's come to fruition. For instance, right? Like right now, a bunch of people are focused on AI and Gen AI, right? There's definitely transformative power in some of these assets for it. The key thing is just making sure that whatever you do at that juncture, right, helps you on the actual valuation on exit. And what I would tell you there is, like, we were looking at one asset recently, and, you know, we looked at it and said, listen, you actually are really well positioned. You've done a great job on this asset, but here are three things that you can do that better position you for a higher valuation on exit, given the strategic nature of this marketplace. Right. And it fundamentally, because we thought ahead, and like every, you know, when you get into the operations, right, like, in, you know, when you sit in the seat, you're worried about the wolf closest to the sled, right? Like the next thing that's coming your way, right? You're not necessarily concerned with looking downstream or the strategic picture that you're potentially in, right? And having somebody else just come in with another set of eyes and look holistically at the organization sometimes is exceptionally helpful for the management team and also the owners, right? Because now they can say, hey, listen, there's another curve that we can jump up that really gets to additional value in this asset. Why don't we undertake that together and see that value accrete?
So this health check is basically, it provides two mechanisms, one for potentially course correcting if there are any underperformance issue, but it also takes into account any kind of, let's say, future looking things that might be on the horizon that you can take advantage of.
That's correct.
If I understood correctly.
Exactly. But the other thing that a lot of the operating partner teams are doing now, everyone kind of has some sort of portfolio monitoring process in place. One of the most advanced that I've heard of recently is they actually will work between the deal team and the operating team. And then they'll actually go red, yellow, green on different assets. If the asset is doing well, it's green. If they're starting to get into trouble, they'll do a yellow. And then if it's not, or like, you know, they might've lost trust in people, right? They might give it a red and say, listen, this asset requires a little bit more attention than the others. And then they'll do different, like they'll have different monitoring mechanisms in place. They might actually say, hey, listen, you know, from the board level, we think that we need an observer on site with you, right? I mean, if things are not really doing well, right? Because, you know, the thing you want to avoid is, it's usually an infrequent occurrence, but there are some times that things go into bankruptcy, right? Or go into insolvency proceedings. And when that happens, right, like it's in no one's interest to have that happen, right? The private equity shops definitely don't want that to happen. And so how do you actually kind of work with the management team to make sure that that doesn't occur, right? And maybe there is somebody like that's a more experienced set of hands that can help the management team that's currently in place get themselves away from that or away from that cliff. And I think that's kind of a smart way to think about asset management.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Maybe a question around resources. So how should PE firms think about resources to improve portfolio company operations. So things like experience levels, in-source versus outsource. And I know that you have co-authored a paper at McKinsey around the private equity. So if you could talk around, you know, this resource question.
Absolutely. So myself and a few of my colleagues, Jose Luis Blanco, Jason Phillips, and Matt Maloney, kind of co-authored this paper called Bridging the Valuation Gap. It's a phenomenal resource. And we really kind of distilled some of this thinking into it. But one of the other areas that we've also started to hear about is, and each fund is different. And the way that you need to think about it is, how does the fund engage with the management team? And what the asset, like the paradigm you have to first ask is, how does the fund want to engage with the management team? And then two, who owns the strategic vision for the asset? Does that truly reside at the CEO level? Is it somewhere in between the CEO and the fund, or is it wholly at the fund level? What you'll oftentimes find is that there might be some benefit to having it at the fund level, or there might be some point of value of having it at the, I'll say, the CEO or the manager level, right? The key thing is just making sure there's like one owner, right? Because all of a sudden your strategic vision gets diluted. But and there's empirical evidence around that concept of what I just said, around like you actually do see a bit of a dumbbell effect, where if you're it's a key thing of just making sure you have one owner of that strategic vision. But what we then saw was, when you have that fully aligned, right, then you get into a discussion of how do you actually get your operating team to support those individuals. Now, if it's somewhere where the strategic vision sits with the fund, maybe the better answer is that you actually have more experienced and more generalist people that can help them on a transformation end to end, right? Because they're not, I mean, they're going to be focused on day to day. You can hire functional expertise at the company to kind of do the things that are necessary. But do you truly have somebody that's there to kind of help guide that entire transformation that you want to have happen to that asset? And as if you think about it, as transformation agendas get bigger and bigger, does that become more and more of a trend? The other option is you say, listen, I bought a great company. I've got a great management team in place. I'm going to make sure that they succeed. And everyone kind of thinks it says the same thing, right? I want to make sure the management succeeds. And so what you can then do is say, listen, you guys are the people. You let us know what you need, and we'll help you, and we'll reinforce your efforts with a bunch of either one specialist or generalist, depending on what you need. And so you kind of get yourself into this almost like 2x2 of what type of relationship are you going to have with the management team? And then what type of expertise do you need? Do you need more functional specialists where like, hey, I'm having a problem with my ERP. I need somebody to come and take a look at it. Or, hey, I'm having a problem with my warehouse, in France. What do I do at that point in time? Right? Like maybe I can land an executive that can kind of come and help and take a look at your warehouse. On the other side of it, where it's, listen, there's a pretty large transformation agenda on this. I know what I kind of want to see. And then I'm going to work with an operating team that's going to go in and deliver this phenomenal result. And they're going to have to own the plan. And there's going to be some give and take to the plan that I'm going to have to align with them on. That's going to then establish a 5-year plan. You're then going to go to an AOP, and then we're going to work together in order to deliver that AOP each year, right? Maybe that's another way that you can also look at it as well, where if that plan is truly aggressive, you really need to kind of make sure that you have a lot of oversight on that asset. And those types of people are different. The other thing that you also want to then factor in is how well the asset is performing relative to that plan, right? If everyone's performing, then we're at status quo. But what happens when it goes into a lower state of performance? Should you change the way that your oversight is manifesting? Some firms are actually thinking that that might be the case.
Interesting. No, this is a lot of great information. Maybe one final question for you, Will. How should we see the future of private equity industry to value creation? What do you see as kind of the main things coming up the pipe in terms of the future of this of the PE industry?
Yeah. So I think I see kind of three or four kind of key trends, right? One is around the management team. Second, there's a lot of discussion on AI, and I'll talk a bit about like what it is and what it isn't. There's a discussion also for the private equity firms of building out more and more internal operating capabilities and like what that looks like in the future. And then there's also some discussion on the supply chain, right, and control towers and like really kind of thinking about how you can improve your signaling through digital twins of the actual supply chain. I'll focus on the first three, then I'll kind of have a very quick dialogue around the fourth. But realistically, like at the end of the day, right, that focus on the management team is critical, right? And there's a lot of firms that have, there's a lot of funds that have placed a lot of attention on that, right, in order to pick the right horse, pick the right team to actually run the race, right? And that's one of the kind of key things that is continually and will always continue to be a focus. I recently overheard someone from one of the top tier retained executive search firms say, listen, that's going to continue to be a focus because there's a gap between, I'll say, the supply and demand, right? And what you're finding is that the supply of really proven private equity leaders is shrinking while the demand is growing. And how do you actually bridge that gap, right? At a certain point, you have to start thinking about what is your actual requirement and what is nice to have, right? If you're talking about somebody that needs to go and run an AI shop, and you're looking for 10 years of experience in AI, that supply is going to be super limited, right? Whereas if you're trying to find somebody that can do AI, maybe it's better to go to someplace where the person has exceptional conceptual problem solving capability. They're a generalist with a lot of horsepower. They've been in an executive position before. And I know that this person can deliver in a private equity setting. Okay, let's give them a shot, right? And then that's what you need in order to kind of bridge that gap. What you also find though is private equity professionals, there's a lot of, they know how to measure risk. And sometimes that risk gap is too large to bridge, to take a risk on a person. On AI, and that's something that they need to kind of reconcile and think through over the coming years. But I think that there's ways to kind of do that. Another kind of key trend is around AI. As a matter of fact, I don't think I've been to a conference this year where people have not said the word AI. As a matter of fact, I'm almost tired of talking about it, but it's actually something that's like, it is truly transformative. And, you know, in my book, I have like two pages on it because it was, I think it was March of last year. Like it was a certain point last year when I was writing that portion. And like, I looked at what was going on with the large language learning models. And I said, wow, okay, this is a transformative thing. Right. And I look at it this way, and this is my personal perspective, right? There's two parts to AI. There's what they call analytical AI, and then there's this generative AI. You do have to think about them separately. We've been doing analytical AI since like the 1970s, right? Machine learning, optimization algorithms, etc. It's gone, right? Like, I mean, everyone knows how to do it. There's Coursera courses. You can take for 6 weeks and you'll basically be up to par with what's going on the analytical AI. On the other side of it, Gen AI is kind of new. And what Gen AI is doing is it's allowing people to structure the logic and the way that people talk, right? So you can now actually kind of quote unquote talk to the machine. And then that allows you to actually have like, and it can talk back to you in a language that you can understand. And that I think is the biggest gap, right? That was the gap. But now when you combine the two, that's where you start to see truly transformative efforts. So I will tell you that one of the things that we've already deployed is, it's at a bigger company, but I'm going to mask this a little bit so that way it's not, it doesn't tell you, but let's say you're a gas utility. And there's a leak in your system. Now, like you have the SCADA system that can kind of go, oh, there's a leak in my system. Okay, now what it can do is it can say, okay, well, listen, there's a leak in my system. Let me query who's around it. Okay, so I know that Joe is the closest repair tech that is qualified on system mains near it. He's 20 minutes away, right? I'm going to send a text through Gen AI to his chat to say, Joe, go to this location. There appears to be a leak. Joe then goes to, you know, he Rogers and says, yep, I'm going to go and do that. He then goes to that leak. Joe had a bunch of commitments on the back end. A schedule optimizer can go in and then go, okay, well, listen, I'm going to optimize this entire schedule. And then I'm going to show, and then I'm going to talk to all the stakeholders through Gen AI again on what is actually going on and what's occurring. And if I need to reschedule, I can reschedule. I can point them to a link, whatever the case is. And then Joe's dispatched. Other people are rerouted to the calendar appointments as needed. And all of that occurs largely seamlessly.
Wow, that's very slick.
Right. And so like all of that can occur now. And that's like now, right? If you think 5 years from now, that horizon goes further. And in my book, I always said this, in the event horizon, right? The point that you can't really see beyond and what will happen to the, like, and I always think about this as leakage and workforce, but like what will happen is when you really start combining that analytical AI and the Gen AI, right? Because now I don't need to necessarily go and talk to somebody as long as I have the right neural nodes that can feed into the Gen AI system and push out the talk track that you need. The other thing that's also potentially happening is you have multiple agents, right? The Gen AI algorithms talking to each other based on some inputs that you're receiving. So, I mean, that's kind of the future of where this is all going. And it's going to get exceptionally complex, right? And you really do need to have some of the best minds thinking about what your AI strategy should be and how do you actually push your organization into this AI future. Because if you don't, then you might find yourself behind the power curve, right? And start to get uncompetitive pretty quickly. And that gap to get out of is a time discussion, but it's also a resource discussion. The building of the internal operating capabilities, that's something that's been going on. I actually gave a speech yesterday I was talking to a number of operating executives yesterday. And I made a comment around like, you know, the operating partners really came into the fold somewhere in the 2015s. Like when you think about like that point when you start to see a lot of them occurring, or a lot of them being there, but you know, you can trace operating partners back to 2006. Right? Like they've been around for a while. There was a blend of them versus senior advisors. I think that you're going to continue to see evolution on what those internal operating capabilities are within the private equity firms and what private equity firms can do to operations, right? Through that mechanism. I think that you're also starting to see a class of people, you know, former consultants, former executives that go into these private equity operating roles. And now that's their career, right? If you look at, we did a survey a few years back and you actually saw that a large number of them actually wanted to do that for a period of time and then go be operating executives at a company. That trend is actually starting to reverse where like, hey, being an operating partner is a career path in the private equity field. I think that what you're also going to see is as value creation becomes more and more important, right? And there are some analyses that you can kind of drive. And once again, like, the analytical number that you have can be different depending on how you cut the data, but like you start to see that sometimes value creation is completely out. It's more of the return profile than any of the financial engineering is. And so if that truly becomes the standard in the case, what does that do to the internal dynamics of different organizations? Do you have to elevate or put at parity some of the power structures inside of some of these private equity funds? I don't know what the answer is, right? I have seen trends where there are operating partners now sitting on the investment committees of general partners. There are some times that you'll see the operating partners become board members of the assets. So that way they can actually strategically direct the asset and what needs to occur. I don't know where that goes. And I think it's also going to be highly dependent on the fund itself, right? There are some funds that just don't want to exert that much control over their teams, over their assets. So I don't know what the right answer is, but it's going to evolve over the next 5 to 10 years.
There is, Platinum Equity, Tom Gores, and his group that I think they trademarked the name M&A and O, so mergers and acquisitions and operations. So they're very rich in operations. So they require that all of their, you know, investment committee members have operational experience. So they're maybe in line with what you're talking about here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that might be the case. I don't have any track record with those folks, but what I would say is I've seen it with others as well, right? You know, and there's always a discussion of how far they want that to go, right? And then when you really start to get into that, like who controls kind of management hiring decisions, right? There's a bunch of other mechanisms that you also have at that point, right? At the end of the day, it's a financial return though. And you do want to have a financially oriented individual at the helm, right? Because the LPs are paying the GP to make sure that they have an adequate investment return, right? And right now, when you're looking at a fund level, depending on which region, et cetera, you're seeing that at around a 1.6x money on money return is kind of what I've seen through some of the analyses that I've cut. But you know, there's a lot of value that's out there, right? And if you think about that, right, it's if you give them $100, you're getting 160 back in 5 years. That's a pretty solid return for the average investor. And now there's a discussion on that versus private credit, but right, that's only I think it's temporal up until the interest rates kind of go back down.
Interesting. Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, William, and really appreciate your time and your sharing your expertise and your insights with us. And I'm sure the listeners will get a lot of knowledge in the private equity world and operational value creation. So thank you so much for participating in the Operations Leadership Podcast.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure. And, you know, and like, I'll just leave the listeners as one thought, like, I think private capital is kind of here to stay, right? And a lot of people really do believe that it's a path to kind of really kind of creating outsized returns. You know, and like I've really appreciated the way that they think about assets and the way that they manage them. So, you know, don't think of any of this as a criticism. As a matter of fact, I think that they do it better than the public markets do, right? Because they actually actively manage and make sure that the company is there to be more profitable and be a better organization in the future.
That's it for this episode of the Operations Leadership Podcast. I'm your host, Gautam Basu. If you like what you're listening to with this podcast series, then please hit subscribe. And until next time.